Okay, welcome. Gonna start us off with a prayer tonight. Thank you so much, Lord, for bringing us here. Thank you for continuing to give us the courage and the willingness to show up, to do the work. Please give us the power to continue to surrender to this process and lift us all up tonight in your name, Lord, that you would open our hearts, open our minds, that you would guide my words. That something from the reading would land on open hearts tonight. And Father, please enable me and all of us to set aside everything we think we know, to allow us to have an open mind and a new experience. Help us to see the truth about our mental obsession before we put a drink or drug into our system. Amen. Okay, so we're on the last part of the mental obsession. We stopped at the top of page 37. We've all met with our groups and gone over our questions. And I wanted to start off tonight with the portion of the questions where we wrote down the 10 most insane things that we did while we were drinking or using. And then as we got into our groups last night or the night before, we all got to recognize what the real most insane thing we have ever done. And that's to go back to a drink or a drug, knowing all of the pain and the suffering and the madness and the craziness that has happened in our lives. The things that occurred are merely circumstances or repercussions of drinking and using. But the real insanity lies in our inability to recognize all of that and a delusion that takes over that allows us to bypass that. And there are even times where the delusion is so sneaky, it can make us to believe that we're doing it in spite of all that. We know all of that. We don't care. We're still going to go back to it. We live in this inability to utilize common sense, rational thinking, to have any type of reasoning. And we go back to it, knowing what's going to happen. And there are also times where the delusion takes over and it's so strong that we're telling ourselves it's going to be different this time. I shared with you guys last week about part of my illusion turning to a delusion that is just telling me that I don't need your help and that a real man never asks for help. And that I'm going to be able to control it. Knowing all of my past. So we finished off last week with Jim's story. And the last sentence that we read was he had much knowledge about himself as an alcoholic, yet all reasons for not drinking were easily pushed aside in favor of the foolish idea that he could take whiskey if only he mixed it with milk. See, it doesn't matter how this insanity slips into my mind. It's going to find a way to manipulate me. It's going to find a way to allow me to do what I'm striving so hard not to against my will. And worst case scenario, it's telling me that I am actually making that choice. I'm consciously making that choice to go back to drugs and alcohol. because I'm a grown man, because I deserve it, because I'm entitled, because I wasn't that bad, whatever the case may be. Remember, the doctor's opinion told us that we are completely unable to differentiate the true from the false. And that's what he's talking about there. We're in this place, in this disease of alcoholism and drug addiction, where we're incapable of common sense, of rationalizing, of recognizing our truth. We are unable to bring into our consciousness, it says in there, is a solution, the suffering and the humiliation of maybe a day ago or a week ago or a month ago or 2 years ago. So whatever the precise definition of the word may be, we call this plain insanity. How can such a lack of proportion of the ability to think straight be called anything else? Now, I'm sure we've heard many times that the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, looking for different results. But what I've come to find out is the true definition of insanity in my life is to have a solution laid out in front of me and not utilize it. That's insanity. And so I'm going to go to the grace of God in my life and ask him to please enable me to set aside all these things I think I know so that I may invite him in for some healing. This is one part of our disease that God can really go to work in if we allow him to show up. He will meet us where we're at. Some of us will have the obsession removed. Some of us have already had the obsession removed. Some of us have had the obsession turned to fleeting thought. Some of us have headed off. We talked last week about heading off this mental obsession if we catch it in time. See, it occurs differently for each and every one of us. But the end result is if it goes from the illusion to delusion to the obsession and it becomes a thought that outweighs all other thoughts, then the chances of me drinking or using are pretty good. Inviting God in the midst of that while it's happening or while I recognize it beginning to happen, there can be healing. There truly can be healing. This last part of more about alcoholism is going to give us a couple more examples and stories. Remember, this whole chapter is hammering home the mental obsession for us. If you ever want to read about the mental obsession, learn more about the mental obsession, engage in this big book at a specific area of your illness, more about alcoholism, mental obsession. And I love the way it's laid out. So it says, you may think this is an extreme case. What's an extreme case? Jim, right? Putting whiskey in the milk, said how suddenly the thought came to his mind. And then vaguely he sensed that he wasn't being all too smart. Well, to us, it's not far-fetched. For this kind of thinking has been characteristic of every single one of us. Who's us? The 100 that wrote this book. Do I believe that? Do I believe that this kind of thinking has been characteristic to every single one of us? If I'm sitting here tonight and I'm relating to what is coming out of my mouth, then the question is, well, do I believe that these people that wrote this book also felt the same way? Do I believe that these people have laid out a real solution for me? Am I going to engage in this program of action? You see, if you become a little bit uncomfortable in the last 8 weeks at certain times or going over some of these questions or reflecting in the insanity of your past, you are in exactly the right place. That is exactly where you want to be. In fact, if there was zero uncomfortability going through this, maybe there wasn't enough honesty going on. or let's say honest reflection going on, whatever it may be. The point is to become uncomfortable, to relate to circumstances in our life that are beyond our mental control, that are beyond human aid, because now we're going to walk into the solution. And 2 weeks from now, we are going to be in the solution for the remainder of the workshop. That's why we spent so long in the first step. In the first step lies my problem, and next week we'll finish it off with the spiritual malady. So we have sometimes reflected more than Jim did upon the consequences. So maybe Jim didn't think enough about it, and he went and he drank anyway. Some of us have contemplated all of the madness that has happened. What we're looking for here, what we're trying to see in our own truth, is that no matter how much we've reflected on what's happened or how little we've reflected, ultimately, we went back to a drink or a drug against our own will. That's the point. And to recognize that I have no power of choice. And at the end of this chapter, it's going to let us know exactly where our defense has to come from. So sometimes they've reflected more than Jim did upon the consequences, but there was always a curious mental phenomenon that parallel our sound reasoning. You see, I've got this moral compass. We all have it. I've got this sound reasoning in my life. That's where Jim said I vaguely sensed that I wasn't being all too smart, right? So the mental phenomenon parallels that sound reasoning. And there inevitably ran some insanely trivial excuse for taking the first drink or drug. See, it doesn't matter what that excuse is. We don't focus on the excuse. We want to see, I have to see in my illness that the mental obsession is going to come in a plethora of excuses, all different forms. What matters is that my sound reasoning that's paralleling this mental phenomenon that's going on rarely wins out. In fact, it only wins out as I have gained the self-knowledge about myself, I see it happening, and I start to take some action. It has to be honest action. I've taken action in the past without recognizing the true nature of my wrongs and the true face of my malady, and I found myself immersed in Alcoholics Anonymous and still went out and drank again because I didn't know what form that delusion was coming in. I know today, and I've said it before and I'll say it again, because I would hope that as you guys go through this process, you can find some form of principle in your life that has been driving the madness. And for me, it's that a real man never asks anybody for help, because that's weak. And fear of failure is my biggest fear, because I can't look bad to anybody. So I have to carry around this facade of I'm better than you. Right. So those ideas right there is that delusion is going to be sneaky and it's going to hit me from all different sides, circumstances, thoughts. But now that I can see the truth in it, I can lift that up to God. So today I have a pretty good chance of allowing this vague sense, this sound reasoning, to outweigh the mental phenomenon that occurs. But if I deny that a mental phenomenon exists in the illness of Alcoholics Anonymous and will try and find a way to tell me that I don't have this disease, then I may be in trouble. Our sound reasoning failed to hold us in check. The insane idea won out. And then what happens? The remorse, the regret, the self-loathing. Next day, we would ask ourselves, in all earnestness and sincerity, how could this have happened? How did it happen again? Why? What did I do to deserve this? I've been working a program. I've been earnestly seeking God. This thing's going to come at us in all different shapes and forms. And I think acknowledging that particular weakness in our life and seeing it as a form of strength and inviting the power of God in for our true defense, we can really begin to heal. There's humility in going to God and saying, you know what, I'm weak here. I have no power here. Because remember, that's what we're doing. We're conceding to our innermost selves that we're powerless, that we're an alcoholic, that our lives are unmanageable, that we need help. And we're admitting that we're beyond human aid. So this is going to be our justification, right? And again, it comes in so many different forms. We underlined what we can relate to in this paragraph. So in some circumstances, we have gone out deliberately to get drunk. See, that's one way my mental obsession is going to tell me. That's what I was just talking about. I know the circumstances. I know my past. I don't care. I'm doing it anyway. That's ridiculous. Unless one is completely suicidal, which I would hope you would get some outside help. That's a ridiculous idea. I did it on purpose. I chose to do it. I didn't care the circumstances. We feel ourselves justified by nervousness, anger, worry, depression, jealousy, or the like. So we're suffering from that restlessness, that irritability, that discontented feeling, right? We're nervous. We might be angry. We're worried. We're depressed. That's the malady that we're going to talk about next week, coming in all these different forms. That's what drives this mental obsession. The mental obsession and the malady is the insanity in our life. The physical allergy we suffer from is a fact. It's a qualification that differentiates us from other people. Once we start, we can't stop. We've recognized that. We see that. Remember, the further we get away from the drink, that becomes irrelevant, right? I'm not taking that to God and say, hey, can you remove that? Help me with that. There is no helping us with that. If you suffer from the phenomenon of craving, if you truly do, once you put poison in your system, you will crave more and you will do it against your own will and you will not be able to control it. But see, this feeling of nervousness and anger and worry and depression and jealousy and the restlessness, the irritability, the discontented feeling that start to drive this delusion, that's the insanity. And we're about to come to believe that a power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity, can heal us. And we can become recovered addicts and alcoholics. But even in this type of beginning, we are obliged to admit that our justification for a spree was insanely insufficient in the light of what always happened. You see, we can't see that until after the fact. If I can reflect honestly, it could be helpful. But reflecting honestly in the midst of a spiritual malady and a mental obsession is rather dangerous. Because what happens is that tape that I'm going to play back, I'm going to change the tape. I'm going to make that tape play what I want to hear. And it's usually going to say, this is where your ease and comfort is going to come from. Just go here. This is going to kill your pain. This is going to help you. Talk about a lie, right? And I can't see the difference. We now see that when we began to drink deliberately instead of casually, there was little serious or effective thought during the period of premeditation of what the terrific consequences might be. Why? Because I'm living in a lie. I'm living in a delusion and an illusion. Remember, right? This false or erroneous perception of reality, the illusion. The delusion to mislead, my mind's being misled. I'm sitting in an obsession that is creating thoughts that outweigh all other thoughts. So, of course, there's no period of premeditation of what the terrific consequences might be. Our behavior is absurd and incomprehensible with respect to the first drink is that of an individual with a passion, say, for jaywalking. So I asked you guys maybe to write your own jaywalker story. And what I meant by that was as you read these, this next paragraph, to see yourself in it, to see the insanity. Some of it becomes redundant at times, but I do not believe that we can revisit the insanity in our lives enough. Given the fact that I'm suffering from an obsession, a delusion, illusion, and a malady that's going to lie to me and tell me it doesn't exist. So looking at this jaywalking story, I can see the insanity in my life. So he gets a thrill out of skipping in front of fast-moving vehicles. He enjoys himself for a few years in spite of friendly warnings. So I'm starting to use drugs, starting to drink, 13 years old, right? Couple of friends, I turned 15, friendly warning, oh, I overdosed on gypsum weed, ended up in the hospital. Up to this point, you would label him as a foolish chap having queer ideas of fun. He's just a young kid. He's just a teenager, adolescent, just living his life. Everybody does it. Don't worry about him. He's going to grow out of it. Luck then deserts him and he is slightly injured several times in succession. So now I start a family. I start to lie. I start to manipulate. I start to cheat. Alcohol becomes the most important thing in my life. Drugs and selling them become the most important thing in my life. You would expect him, if he was normal, to cut it out. Well, yeah, why wouldn't this frothy emotional pill that the book talks about stop me? Why wouldn't I be able to reflect at that point? Like, hey, man, something's off here. You know, you're young, you got a family, starting a business. Why don't you just chill out? Presently, he is hit again, and this time he has a fractured skull. So I'm going to come into Alcoholics Anonymous, finally, after years of pain. After infidelity, after blown relationships, I'm going to ask for some help. Within a week after leaving the hospital, a fast-moving trolley car breaks his arm. I make it 14 days without getting high and drinking, and I get high again in the program. And I continue to go to meetings. But I'm not drinking, so I'm okay. I continue to go to meetings. My wife sees that I'm lying. I'm living a lie. I'm coming home. I'm hitting the bong after meetings. But it's okay, honey. Don't worry about it. Start taking pills again. Still going to meetings. Ask my sponsor, hey, man, can you give me a token anyway? You know, hey, look, I've been getting high, but I haven't had a drink. No, man, I can't give you a token. And you need to go and introduce yourself as a newcomer. You need to start over. Okay. He tells you he's decided to stop jaywalking for good. But in a few weeks, he breaks both legs. tell everybody in the meetings, all my friends, all the fellowship, man, I'm back. This is where I've been. I come clean. I'm a fraud. On through the years, his conduct continues, accompanied by his continual promises to be careful or to keep off the streets altogether. I'm driving my wife crazy. She's living with somebody who's going through this cycle of sobriety and lying and going to meetings and living in this delusion and pretending and promising. Okay, throw the pills away. Okay, put the bong away. Okay, no more drinking. Okay, I'm gonna go back and introduce myself again. I'm gonna be honest with my sponsees. Promise, honey, I'm not doing it again. Finally, he can no longer work. His wife gets a divorce and he's held up to ridicule. Jason, I can't take this cycle you're going through anymore. I cannot take what you're putting me through. Either abandon this program and do what you do, or come clean with these people. I'm sick of this. You are driving me nuts. Can't live with you like this anymore. He tries every known means to get the jaywalking idea out of his head. So I'm going to fight it, and I'm going to fight it, and I'm going to fight it. I'm going to work the steps again. I'm going to pray, and I'm going to meditate. I'm going to take people through the work. I'm going to start a workshop. He shuts himself up in asylum, hoping to mend his ways. But the day he comes out, he races in front of a fire engine, which breaks his back. Oh, you know what? I think I'm just done with this. I'm just gonna have a glass of wine with you. What do you mean? You're starting a workshop. What do you mean? You got a year and 8 months. You're doing so good. Nah, I'm done. I've decided. I'm not doing AA no more. I'm going to text everybody. I'm going to tell them. I'm going to tell Luis I'm not doing the workshop. Such a man would be crazy, wouldn't he? Insanity. See, that's what I mean when I ask you guys, write your own jaywalker story. Just do some notes, put it in your little binder, just so you can reflect on it and see it from time to time. What's your insanity? Because sometimes it's hard for us to see. And that's just one little off-the-cuff example. I wasn't reading. I tried to find my jaywalker story, but I couldn't find it. I wrote it a few years ago. It's important for us to recognize that this isn't some ridiculous story about a jaywalker in a book of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is a story about a mental obsession, and no matter what happens in our life, the inability to control going back, the inability to be able to stay stopped on our own power. So you may think our illustration is too ridiculous, but is it? We who have been through the ringer have to admit if we substituted alcoholism for jaywalking, the illustration would fit us exactly. However intelligent we may have been in other respects, where alcohol has been involved, we have been strangely insane. It's strong language, but isn't it true? So we're not here to beat ourselves up. We're not here to get in this place of self-hate and self-pity and I'm never going to be good enough and I'm less than and I knew it. I'm just a piece of junk. We're here to understand that in the rest of our lives, we're usually pretty solid. But when it comes to drugs and alcohol, we've got nothing. We've got no fight. We've got no hope on our own power. Where alcohol has been involved, we have been strangely insane. Strong language. Some of you are thinking, yes, what you tell us is true, but it doesn't fully apply. We admit we have some of these symptoms, but we have not gone to the extremes you fellows did. nor are we likely to, for we understand ourselves so well after what you have told us that such things cannot happen again. We have not lost everything in life through drinking, and we certainly do not intend to. Thanks for the information. See, that's a powerful paragraph there that's talking to the people that may have stopped in time, that may have saved themselves years and years of suffering. Recognizing that is difficult at times. It's hard to do. What they're saying there is that the knowledge you've given me is enough, and there's no way that I can go back to it after what you've told me. You see, if that was the truth, then we could stop right here. If you are a real alcoholic or an addict, I doubt that you'd be able to stop right here. But again, we're not here to proclaim anybody alcoholic. That's completely and utterly up to you. So that may be true for certain non-alcoholic people, who, though drinking foolishly and heavily at the present time, are able to stop or moderate because their brains and bodies have not been damaged as ours were. So remember, we read a little while ago that if one can go out and drink or use like a gentleman, our hats are off to them, right? And maybe you haven't reached that point. But being a potential alcoholic does not necessarily mean that you won't become an alcoholic. But the actual or potential alcoholic, with hardly an exception, will be absolutely unable to stop drinking on the basis of self-knowledge. So that's what we were just talking about. If you are the real deal, everything that I've talked about in the last few weeks is not going to be enough. It is very helpful. Remember, the ex-problem drinker or user can get through to the new person so much faster in a matter of hours when they're properly armed about facts of themselves. So the self-knowledge is very helpful for us when it comes to working with other people, and when it comes to honest reflection, if we have the ability to do so. But remember, our sound reasoning that parallels this curious mental phenomenon, the insane idea usually wins out. So we have to be very careful. We're not trying to think our way through going back. Because if that was the case, then we could also stop here. And then just think our way through. When we started feeling restless and irritable and discontented, and our mind was telling us that it's going to be different, and you deserve it, and it's okay, and you're not really an addict or an alcoholic, we would be able, with sufficient force, to bring into our minds the humility and the suffering and the horror and the terror that had happened in the past. But we can't do that. This is a point we wish to emphasize and re-emphasize. Very, very important. We cannot think our way out of this. We are here to redirect our thinking. We don't have the ability to do that. God has the power to do that. God has the power to help us to change our attitudes and our emotions and our ideas and to fill us with new conceptions and motives. I do not have the power to do that. I need his help in order to redirect my thinking. And this program of action is the springboard to that new design for living, for us to be able to redirect this thinking through the power greater than ourselves, not on our own. So they're emphasizing this and re-emphasizing this. And it says to smash home upon our alcoholic readers, as it has been revealed to us out of bitter experience. So they're sharing with us over and over, and we're also relating with our own experience. Emphasize, re-emphasize, smash home, right? The idea that I am somehow, someday, or ever will be like other people has to be smashed. It has to be smashed over and over and over. Re-emphasize, I'm different. I'm not weaker. I'm different. I need a spiritual solution in my life in order to remain sober. That's it. It's not a bad thing. Can be scary at times because it involves an element of surrender and destruction of self-centeredness, which is all new to me. Because I've spent my whole life thinking of me and what's important to me and what I can get from you and what that looks like and how I can manipulate you and how I can make you do what I want, how I can make you like me. So we're going to take another illustration. Now, this is the story of Fred. This is my favorite story, and the reason why it's my favorite story, I can relate to it, but also because it has a happy ending. It's the only story in More About Alcoholism that has a happy ending. Fred actually worked the program of action, but not before he did some pretty intense suffering. It took some brutal experiences for him to succumb to what these people that were trying to help him were telling him. So Fred is a partner in a well-known accounting firm. His income is good. He has a fine home, is happily married, and the father of promising children of college age. He has so attractive a personality that he makes friends with everyone. So maybe you've been like that at a time in your life. Maybe you're too young to have been married or to own a home. Or the point is, if we find something here that we can relate to, it can become so much more powerful for us. I don't think I had such an attractive personality that I made friends with everyone. I think that I was so full of crap and told you what you wanted to hear, that I went through life coming off as like the cool guy and the guy you wanted to be friends with, when inside I was just empty and hurting. And began using drugs and drinking in the first place just to connect with something, with some people that I met. I hated it when I started. I got so sick. I remember asking my friends, you guys actually like this? Because all of my friends have always been 4 or 5 years older than me. And so I just kept going. Till I couldn't control it and couldn't stop. If ever there was a successful businessman, it's Fred. To all appearance, he is a stable, well-balanced individual. Yet, he is alcoholic. We first saw Fred about a year ago in a hospital where he had gone to recover from a bad case of jitters. So Fred went into a hospital. He was super nervous. Anxiety, right? I don't know that they had that word in the 30s or that they had that diagnosis. It was a case of the jitters. It was his first experience of this kind. And he was much ashamed of it. Far from admitting he was an alcoholic, he told himself he came to the hospital to rest his nerves. The doctor intimated, suggested strongly that he might be worse than he realized. For a few days, he was depressed about his condition. He made up his mind to quit drinking altogether. So he sees the writing on the wall. He sees the problem. He's got a business. He's got a family. He's a likable guy. He's he's beginning to recognize that I'm drinking a little bit too much here. Something's off. And the doctor says, you're way worse off than you think you know. You might want to get some help. Fred says, no way. I'm going to make up my mind. I'm not doing this no more. I got the willpower. Now remember, he didn't have any knowledge about recovery or anything at this point. It never occurred to him that perhaps he could not do so. See, the thought didn't even cross his mind that he wouldn't be able to quit on his own power. Why? Because of his character and his standing in the community. He was an important guy. Fred would not believe himself an alcoholic, much less accept a spiritual remedy for his problem. There's no way I'm going into this whatever's going on around me where these alcoholics are going and beginning to recover. I don't have the problem. I don't need the help. That's ridiculous. So he came in contact with people, the first 100. And they told him what they knew of alcoholism. So it grabbed him. Remember, the ex-problem drinker can get through more than a doctor, more than a friend, more than a spouse. So he meets a couple guys that are out there helping other alcoholics. They tell him about the first step and the powerlessness and the unmanageability and the phenomenon of craving and this restless, irritable, discontented feeling, because why? They relate. They get it. They've been there. So what does Fred do? He's interested and conceded that he had some of the symptoms. He said, you know what? You guys are making sense. There you go. What else you got for me? See, but Fred, he was a long way from admitting that he could do nothing about it himself. So they told him of the solution. We're going to surrender this to the power of God, man. My friend says, whoa, wait a minute. No, that's ridiculous. Do you know who I am? I'm Fred. I'm successful. I got money. I still got a house and two cars in the garage. I can do it myself. He was positive that this humiliating experience plus the knowledge he had acquired would keep him sober for the rest of his life. Self-knowledge would fix it. So he talked with a couple guys, gained some knowledge about the phenomenon of craving, the mental obsession, the malady, his inability to stop on his own power. And he said, you know what? That's enough. I see that. I'm just going to stop right here. Thank you guys, but no thanks. So we heard no more of Fred for a while. Off you go. One day we were told that he was back in the hospital. It didn't take long. Remember, the carpet slippers was dead within 4 years, right? Jim lost his business, started drinking again. They didn't even tell us what happened to Jim. Can only imagine. Jaywalker has to get run over by a fire truck and still doesn't stop. Right? Insanity. Jim says, or Fred says, no, thank you. Huh. How many times have you worked with someone and then they disappear? Or they come in, they ask for help, they disappear. And then 6 months, a year, 2, 3 years later, here they come walking back in the rooms. Head down, tail between the legs, going up to the podium crying. Yeah. So same difference. Maybe that's happened in your life. It's happened to me. I did it. I walked out. Later, guys, don't need you. Come back crying. Literally. June 5th, 2024, walked into a meeting across the street here in Alpine. Cried my eyes out like a little baby. You know what someone told me? Don't take this the wrong way, but I've been praying that this exact thing would happen in your life and bring you back here. Well, I couldn't really comprehend that at the time. I do today. Thank God for his prayers. So Fred's back in the hospital, and this time he's quite shaky. He soon indicated he was anxious to see us. So now he's back. He says, where are those guys at that told me all this? I'm willing to go. Let's move forward here. He soon indicated he was anxious to see us. And the story he told us is most instructive. For here was a chap absolutely convinced he had to stop drinking, who had no excuse for drinking, who exhibited splendid judgment and determination in all his other concerns, yet was flat on his back nevertheless. The disease of alcoholism does not pick and choose its sufferers. Doesn't hit a certain demographic or a certain class. Rich people, poor people, homeless people. Doesn't matter. Remember, we are all people that would not normally mix, and here we sit today because we have a common problem. We also have a common solution, and that's the cement that's going to bind us together. Even well after this workshop is done, there'll be a couple of people in here that you grab onto and that become close. Support group. It's important. Let him tell you about it. So here's Fred's words. I was much impressed with what you fellows said about alcoholism, and I frankly did not believe it would be possible for me to drink again. I rather appreciated your ideas about the subtle insanity which precedes the first drink. See, they're telling about the mental obsession. But I was confident it could not happen to me after what I had learned. Why is it a subtle insanity? Because it's a liar. Because it will drive you to do things, this pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization that you promised you would never, ever do again. How is that even possible? We're going to acknowledge that it exists. And we're going to continue to seek out the power that can stop it. That's all we're doing. So I reasoned that I was not so far advanced as most of you fellows, that I had been usually successful in licking my other personal problems, and that I would therefore be successful where you men fail. I felt I had every right to be self-confident that it would be only a matter of exercising my willpower and keeping on guard. So that's all Fred thought he had to do. Thanks for the info. Man, there's no way I'm not as bad as you. In this frame of mind, I went about my business, and for a long time, all was well. I had no trouble refusing drinks and began to wonder if I had not been making too hard work of a simple matter. And the asterisk says, just being sober never kept me sober. And it don't matter how long of a stint it was. I wasn't able to stay stopped. And that's our goal here. All together, stay stopped, one day at a time. That's what we're doing. One day I went to Washington to present some accounting evidence to a government bureau. I had been out of town before during this particular dry spell, so there was nothing new about it. Physically, I felt fine. Neither did I have any pressing problems or worries. My business came off well. I was pleased and knew my partners would be too. It was the end of a perfect day, not a cloud on the horizon. That's my experience right there. That's me. Not bad times, good times. Good times. Why? Well, how does it lie to me? You deserve it. Everything's great. You don't need this program. You don't even need the power of God. Look at all that you have done. Go celebrate. Man, you know how many Fridays have come up for me? And that fleeting thought pops into my mind as soon as I'm in my truck driving home. I can't even count. And that's when it happens. Big check in the hand. Boom. Payday. JT Coden's got a fat check today. All the guys worked all week long, weekend in front of me. What sounds good? Get loaded. That's the way it comes on. Not all my wife is, hates me and we're fighting and I slept in a separate room last night and I'm falling back on my program and I'm not being compassionate. And dude, those are the moments where I'll either sit in anger or ultimately I'll talk to somebody about it and I'll walk it back to getting on my knees, just asking God for help. It's the good times for me. I don't know what your experience has been. This is just mine. The end of a perfect day, not a cloud on the horizon. Danger. Danger. And there has been more days like that in my life in the last 7.5 years than ever in my whole entire life. Got to keep working this program. So what did Fred do? Well, he went to his hotel and leisurely dressed for dinner. As I crossed the threshold of the dining room, the thought came to mind that it would be nice to have a couple of cocktails with dinner. That was all, nothing more. You see, when that fleeting thought hits me on the Friday afternoon on the way home, the very next thought is, man, you are crazy. God help me. God help me to see that this is true strength, that sobriety is where you want me. Please relieve me of this thinking. Help redirect my thinking. See, Fred didn't have that right then. Fred's got this sudden insanity happening. The mental obsession that's starting to take over. And how does it come to him? A thought that comes to mind that it would be nice to have a couple of cocktails. That's how it came to him. It'd be nice. That was it. How did it come to Jim? Well, you know, if I just have some whiskey and some milk, it should be okay, right? Scary. It's a liar. It's a liar. It's a liar. It's a liar. The truth must come from God. We cannot differentiate the truth from the false. Ever. And if we're walking through today, and the mental obsession has been removed, and we are able to honestly reflect on our path, that is through the power of God. That is through a relationship that's building in our lives. And then what do? We become this channel or this vessel, and we start sharing that with other people, right? So see that when you're in a meeting and people say the obsession has been removed, and maybe if you're not experiencing that, just understand, all that's happened is the power of God is real and it's working in their lives. And it can work in your life too. Maybe it already has. I know there's members here tonight that have been sober for some time. So this thought just crossed his mind. It would be nice. That was all, nothing more. That was it. I'm just going to have a couple. So what does he do? He ordered a cocktail and his food. Well, what comes after a cocktail? You see, I'm not going to throw it all away for the first drink, but I will for the second. You see? Think about that for a minute. I will for the second. Throw it all away. What does that mean? That means I'm in such a delusion when I take that first drink. I'm living such a lie. The mental obsession is on me. But after that poison's in me, the craving kicks in, I'm totally hopeless. I'm throwing it all away because all that's happening is another one. That's it. So what did Fred do? He ordered another cocktail. After dinner, he decided to take a walk. When he returned to the hotel, it struck me that a highball would be fine. So now instead of the thought was nice, now it struck him, boom. It wasn't the thought anymore. The phenomenon of craving's kicking in for Fred. He's hopeless. He's going to drink till oblivion is what's going to happen. So he stepped into the bar and he had one. He said, oh, I'm just going to have a highball before I go to bed. I've already had a couple of cocktails with dinner. Then what? He remembers This is what he remembers. Having several more that night and plenty the next morning. Right? The spree is occurring now, right? What's going to happen? He's going to wake up remorseful, resentful. How did this happen again? I have a shadowy recollection of being in an airplane, bound for New York, finding a friendly taxi cab driver at the landing field instead of my wife. The driver escorted me about for several days. I know little of where I went or what I said and did. Then came the hospital with unbearable mental and physical suffering. So that's what happened to Fred. See, that doesn't happen to me, but it doesn't matter. I'm not going to disappear for 3 days. That's not the way that I use and drink. But does it matter? What matters is for me to see through it and to understand that I'm going to do this against my will. That a mental obsession driven by discomfort in my life is going to become so powerful and overwhelming that it's going to hit me in all these different ways, subtle ways, heavy waves, ways of happiness, sadness, doesn't matter. And once I start, I can't stop. That's what matters, right? It's important for me to see through, because there's been times where I look at that and I read that and I go, well, I didn't really drink to blackout. And I surely never disappeared for days at a time. I was never in an asylum or jail. But if I stay there, then that's another form of a delusion starting to build in my life that's tricking me to say, Jason, you're not one of us. Go ahead. Scary. So as soon as I regained my ability to think, I went carefully over that evening in Washington. Not only had I been caught off guard, I had made no fight whatsoever against the first drink. This time, I had no thought of the consequences at all. So he didn't fight at all. And he's reflecting, like, how is that possible? What happened? I had commenced to drink as carelessly as though the cocktails were ginger ale. And bam, it hits him. I now remember what my alcoholic friends had told me. How they prophesized that if I had an alcoholic mind, the time and the place would come and I would drink. It's a very powerful statement. So if left untreated and you have the mind of a chronic alcoholic, or addict, you will drink or use again. That sucks. You mean I can't do this on my own? With everything you've told me here for the last 8 weeks? Then what's the point? I just want to stop. They had said that though I did raise a defense, that it would one day give way for some trivial reason for having a drink. The curious mental phenomenon. Remember we read last week, the mental states that precede a relapse are the crux of the problem. The center of the problem. The stuff that's going through my mind before I drink is the center of my problem. And we are here to lift that up to God and to thwart it off before the thoughts even start to take over by recognizing the level of discomfort that's beginning to take place in our lives. Well, just that did happen and more. For what I had learned of alcoholism did not occur to me at all. I knew from that moment that I had an alcoholic mind. There's a little bit of surrender there. Fred surrendered a little bit. I saw that willpower and self-knowledge would not help in those strange mental blank spots. Had a realization there, understood that he's beyond human aid, came to believe in a power greater than themselves. He'd never been able to understand people who said that a problem had them hopelessly defeated. Why? Because those people are weak and I'm strong. Well, now I know, and it's a crushing blow. So now Fred says, I get it. I see it. I can't do anything about this. Two of the members of Alcoholics Anonymous came to see me. They grinned, which I didn't like so much. And then they asked me if I thought myself an alcoholic and if I were really licked this time. Are you done, man? Are you ready to surrender? Do you believe what we've been telling you? Are you willing to work a program of action? I had to concede both propositions. I believe what you're saying, and I'm licked. They piled on me heaps of evidence to the effect that an alcoholic mentality such as I had exhibited in Washington was a hopeless condition, which is all that we've been talking about through this whole chapter. They cited cases out of their own experience by the dozen, which each one of us could do. Each one of us could share an instance of a mental obsession that has occurred in our life. And that's what we do when we sit down with another fellow sufferer that doesn't know anything about the solution. Just like they're doing with Fred. So this process snuffed out the last flicker of conviction that I could do the job myself. That's why it's so important for us to be honest about the struggles that we have gone through in order to try and master this disease on our own power and share that with the people that are asking us for help. Because that's what these people did with Fred, and it finally opened his eyes. Opened his eyes to what? To snuff out the last flicker of conviction that he could do the job himself. Opened his eyes to what? To concede to his innermost self that he was truly an alcoholic. Because he just got through telling us how alcoholics are weak, and I'm strong. So then they outlined the spiritual answer and a program of action, which 100 of them have followed successfully. And that's right where we're going to be headed in the next few weeks. Though I had only been a nominal churchman, their proposals were not intellectually hard to swallow. So the belief in God for Fred was not difficult for him to fathom, to say, okay, I can buy into that. Sure, I already believe. But the program of action, though entirely sensible, was pretty drastic. Now they're telling Fred, okay, well, not only do you want to believe in this power and surrender your life to it, but you're going to have to take a moral inventory. You're going to have to confess all your shortcomings to somebody else. You're going to lift up these objectionable things to God, and then you're going to have to go out and make amends. And then you're going to have to continue to recognize where you're falling short. Pray and meditate every day, and then go and carry this message to somebody else. And if I had to guess, Fred was probably like, there's no way I'm doing this moral inventory, confessing to anybody, and making amends to people. Because those are usually the places where most of us get wadded up. It meant I would have to throw several lifelong conceptions out the window. I believe the most important statement in the whole chapter. I believe maybe even the most important statement that I've read yet so far. Throwing several lifelong conceptions out the window. Old ideas, attitudes, emotions, and ideas that used to drive me, guide me, are now replaced by a whole new set of conceptions and motives. Now, remember, we read the spiritual experience that talks about sudden and profound experiences are pretty erroneous, meaning like you don't have to expect it like that in your life. It's of the educational variety. It's one day at a time. Continue to recognize the change that's required. Continue to but how can I throw out lifelong conceptions if I don't know what they are? How can I throw out a lifelong conception in my life if I've never been guided to actually put it on paper and see it? Lifelong conceptions are principles that have been driving us. That's what they are. And that's what we want to look at when we get to this, especially if you've done an inventory in the past. looking for principles today is probably going to be one of the most important, because there are areas that we are holding on to. There are ideas that drive us and guide us and create attitudes and emotions that we're not always okay with or comfortable with. That was not easy, but the moment I made up my mind to go through the process, I had the curious feeling that my alcoholic condition was relieved, as in fact it proved to be. So he said, you know what? I'm doing it. What does he mean by the alcoholic condition was relieved? The mental obsession. He's no longer obsessing about going back to a drink. He's no longer giving in to a nice idea of a cocktail with dinner, or being struck with the thought that a highball before bed would be okay. He's not battling that anymore. Now he's just focusing on throwing lifelong conceptions out. Quite as important was the discovery that spiritual principles would solve all my problems. See, when I'm hanging on to lifelong conceptions, and the deepest one for me is that a real man never asks for help. And if I sit on that lifelong conception, and I can prove it to you as truth in my life, because I'm self-made and I'm successful, but I've never asked for help, when I came from a poor background and a broken home, how can I discover that spiritual principles are going to solve all my problems? Seeing that spiritual principles will solve all my problems is going to involve me asking somebody for some help. And not just God, because I'm working this program of action. So that's what Fred decided to do. And what happened to Fred? He has since been brought into a way of living infinitely more satisfying, and I hope more useful than the life I lived before. But here's another really good statement. My old manner of life was by no means a bad one, but I would not exchange its best moments for the worst I have now. I would not go back to it even if I could. You hear people in meetings say, I wouldn't exchange my worst day sober for my best day drinking, right? That's not what Fred says. What does Fred say? Fred says his old manner of life was by no means a bad one. Fred's acknowledging that life before recovery wasn't always bad. There was a time in my life when drinking and using wasn't always bad, right? There are good times, and Fred's acknowledging that. Through that acknowledgement, he backs it up with saying, I would not exchange its best moments for the worst I have now. So making a statement that my life has been very good at times, I think we can all look back and find a certain time in life that was really good before it got bad. Now, to acknowledge that I would not exchange that really good moment, maybe I was in the delusion that I was in control. Maybe I was controlling a little bit. Maybe I was living on the high hog. Maybe I was just really enjoying life. I wouldn't exchange it for the worst that I have now. So those best moments, we're thinking about the toughest times we've had in sobriety, in recovery. There's a willingness there to accept spiritual help. Remember, I asked you guys a few weeks back. What is spiritual health for you? What does that look like? And then I also ask you, are you willing to accept spiritual health? What does that mean? What does that look like? And that's a personal question. Sometimes that spiritual help is painful. Are you in a place where you would never exchange that painful moment of growth for the best moments you've had before you ever walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous? That's a very powerful statement. That's a willingness that is pretty admirable to me. It's a statement that makes me want what Fred has. I would not go back to it even if I could. Wouldn't even go back to it even if I could. So Fred's story speaks for itself. And we hope it strikes home to thousands like him. He had felt only the first nip of the ringer. So Fred didn't have a low bottom. The bottom came up and smacked Fred right in the face. Most alcoholics have to be pretty badly mangled before they really commence to solve their problems. Is that you? I don't want that to be me. Many doctors and psychiatrists agree with our conclusions. One of these men, staff member of a world-renowned hospital, recently made this statement to some of us. What you say about the general hopelessness of the average alcoholic's plight is, in my opinion, correct. As to two of you men whose stories I have heard, there is no doubt in my mind that you were 100% hopeless, apart from divine help. Had you offered yourselves as patients at this hospital, I would not have taken you. Why? Because the doctors can't help us. People like you are too heartbreaking. Though not a religious person, I have profound respect for the spiritual approach in such cases as yours. For most cases, there is virtually no other solution. So I'm a doctor. I recognize how hopeless you are. Not really religious. I don't know that I really believe in God, because I am kind of God, because I'm a doctor in the 30s. But let me tell you something. If you're a hopeless alcoholic, you better believe in God. That's what the doctor just said. Just told him. Why? Because for most cases, there's virtually no other solution. So they're reminding us one more time. And then this is the best reminder of our first step, that once more, the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink, except in a few rare cases. Neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power. His defense has to come from a higher power. If I don't believe the question asked in this paragraph, it means that I still have some reservations about it. If I'm really an alcoholic or an addict. Do you believe that at certain times you have no effective mental defense against the first drink? If you believe that you have a mental defense against the first drink, then maybe we're carrying around some reservations on whether or not we're an alcoholic or an addict. And if my defense must come from a higher power, how can I depend on the group as my higher power? Neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. So we remember the triangle. and the circle in the middle, and the God in the center. And the fellowship is a very big part of it. And the meetings are a very big part of it. And service to other people is a very big part of it. And our own recovery is a very big part of it. That little dot in the center of the circle is the power of God. And we can be whole. And that's where our defense must come from. So we've got some questions to ask ourselves, some consideration, some contemplation. We're not going to be discussing the phenomenon of craving or the mental obsession for the rest of the workshop. We'll talk about our problem next week of the restlessness, the irritability, the discontented feeling, the lack of power in our lives. The homework assignment will be page 44, 45, and 52 out of the book. That's the big book, and you'll find it in your workbook, and the sponsorship guide will tell you the assignment number. And we're going to discuss the spiritual malady. So now we're going to start to get down dirty, and we're going to start to ask ourselves some real questions of, what's my willingness to surrender? How bad am I really suffering? What's my real problem? So yeah, one more week in the first step. I thank each and every one of you that came tonight. I love you all. You know the assignment. If you would like the recording, just let me know. I'll send it to you. Say a little prayer for you guys and for myself. May the Lord bless you and protect you. May the Lord smile on you, be gracious to you. May the Lord show you His favor, give you His peace. Amen.
Thanks, Jason.